And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, you know, quite often, the powers that be don't tell us a lot. They figure the less we know, the less we'll try to interfere with their grandiose plans. And the same is true with World War II. I mean, there's a lot of information that if you went and looked for it, you could have found, but they weren't volunteered. Now, as a rule, what I'm going to talk about is probably applicable to many other major events. And I think by the time we get through, you're not going to look at World War II the same way that you have in the past. And we're not going to change the story of the conflict. We're going to talk about some information that's not generally known. We sometimes look at the same subject from different angles, which gives you a better appreciation of, for example, how a blitzkrieg was conducted, what it took to supply partisans in the field, and why the U.S. Army had more ships than the U.S. Navy did. I mean, even today it has more planes than the Air Force does. Now, World War II was a major drama in history. And it didn't begin in a vacuum. I mean, it just didn't break out suddenly one day. The clouds of war were forming throughout the 1930s. And it set in motion a complex movement of political, social, and economic forces. Now, from 1935 on, there was one nerve-wracking crisis after another as Italy and Germany and Japan flexed their muscles in East Africa, Central Europe, and East Asia. And then during the first week of September 1939, Germany invaded Poland. Now, the reason for that was allegedly Polish forces attacked a German installation, but it was actually German soldiers dressed in Polish uniforms. But however it happened, World War II was underway. Most of the major powers at the time put their armies and navies in motion. But the United States, the greatest industrial power on the planet even then, said, hey, we're neutral. And there was absolutely no enthusiasm by anybody except the president for getting involved. And this would eventually change, though, and you know, we're led to believe it was because the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, but that wasn't exactly true. Now, I'm going to give you a list of the events that you would have read about in the paper had you lived then. Or seen it in the newsreels. I mean, when I went to the movies in the 50s, I remembered the newsreels. Or heard on the radio from 1935 onward. And as you wade through all this, you'll start to get a picture for how World War II began. Now, in 1935, World War I was still a recent memory, and the Great Depression gave most folks the more immediate problems to deal with than what was happening in Europe and Asia. I mean, there were dozens and dozens of folks who'd formerly been workers taking care of their families actually standing in line to get a bowl of soup at the soup kitchens. But throughout the world, you could see that something was happening. And that something wasn't good. Most of the pre-war events, of course, faded into the background of history in comparison with the battles that took place later. And the war didn't begin just because. There were reasons. There were a lot of reasons and plenty of signs that a war was coming. And these signs still reappear today, indicating to those in the know that another world war is absolutely possible. Now let's start with March of 1935. Germany had been forced at the end of World War I to sign what was called the Treaty of Versailles. And Germany, in March of 35, renounced the terms of the treaty. They said, we're not going to comply with it anymore. And in effect, they began to openly rearm their military. There had been several serious disarmament conferences during the 20s, and serious naval disarmament treaties had been signed and carried out. At the end of World War I, the Versailles Treaty effectively disarmed Germany. And during the early 1930s, only the Soviet Union, Japan, and Italy were rearming. Now, Germany was quietly and secretly getting ready to rearm, but they didn't want anybody to see it. But then Germany publicly announced its intention to rearm, and a lot of Europeans and Americans feared there was going to be another war. Now, Germany felt it had gotten the wrong deal after World War I. Now, the Germans had not been innocent participants in that war, and all the great powers were responsible for the conflict and the disaster it brought on Europe, but the Germans lost the war. And the French had a big say in what was in the peace terms. Germany was stripped of a lot of territory and basically humiliated. Any competent historian could have predicted, and a number of them did, that on the basis of past experience, this almost guaranteed there's going to be another major war. Now, the end of World War I was also the end of several empires. Many ethnic groups that had been long kept quiet by imperial armies and police were now free to settle ancient scores. So Germany wasn't the only nation looking to get revenge in the 30s. A lot of other folks had gripes as well. The Soviet Union, Hungary, Bulgaria had lost big time in 1918. And of course, Italy and Japan had been among the winners back then, and they felt they didn't get their just desserts. So they all got their revenge as well as a new crop of grudges. And now Germany, the most feared military power for the previous 70 years, was arming itself again. Now, nobody had any doubt that their military had lost any of its ability. They had some military geniuses on their general staff. Now, in August of 35, seeing the handwriting on the wall, the U.S. Congress passed a Neutrality Act that forbid the loan or sale of arms to participants in any foreign wars, which means we couldn't loan or sell any weapons to anybody involved in any of the European wars. Now, this act was brought about partially by the 1934-1936 Nye Committee investigation, which left many Americans with the erroneous impression that the U.S. entry into World War I was largely an effort to make bankers and arms manufacturers rich, the so-called merchants of death. And this led to a resurgence of isolationism, particularly in light of the subsequent Italian invasion of Ethiopia and what the Japanese called incidents with China, and then the Spanish Civil War and the rearming of Germany. And many immigrants who had fled to America in the 1840s and 1930s had done so to escape military service, the same as is happening today with a lot of the undocumented immigrants, as they're politely called, that have swarmed our borders. And a lot of them came to escape the wars and the ethnic strife in the old country. So there was in the American mind a strong aversion to getting involved in foreign wars. And most American politicians played to this attitude, and the result was an American electorate that strongly resisted sending U.S. troops over there anymore. Well, in October of 1935, Italy, without any warning, invaded Ethiopia. League of Nations, which was the precursor to the UN, condemned the aggression and imposed sanctions, including an embargo, but that had no effect beyond allegedly cutting off the supply of tennis balls in Italy. And, of course, without tennis balls, there could have been problems. In May of 1936, Ethiopia was conquered and annexed by Italy. Mussolini had created the first fascist state in Italy. And while fascism contained elements of nationalism and socialism, the might makes right angle caused the most problems. And although most nations condemned the Italian invasion of Ethiopia and the use of chemical weapons, nobody's willing to do anything about it. But then Ethiopia in 1935 didn't have anything like oil that the rest of the world needed. So basically, who cared if Mussolini got a sandbox? March 1936, Germany sent troops marching into Rhineland, which under the Treaty of Versailles was to remain free of German troops. Well, Hitler decided to go for broke and sent troops in. And the French, who had insisted on that as part of the Treaty of Versailles, said nothing. And that was the first of Germany's diplomatic gains through the use or threatened use of military force that would eventually lead to World War II. In July of 1936, civil war broke out in Spain between conservative nationalists and leftist loyalists. In weeks, fascist nations Italy and Germany began sending aid to the nationalists, and the Soviet Union supported the loyalists, as did 60,000 Soviet-recruited individuals from other countries. That was the first war to see the wide use of modern aircraft and armored vehicles, and fighting went on until March of 1939. Now, the royal family of Spain, of which I'm related, had been in and out of power. Generals held a lot of power in that country, and Franco wound up being the strong man, though he eventually put a king back on the throne, and then when he died, everybody swore a loyalty to the king. Nearly 500,000 people died in the Spanish Civil War. Foretaste of what would happen in World War II. And the performance of German troops and weapons impressed and scared the rest of the world. Germany showed it had not lost any of its military ability. Now, in November 1936, Japan signed what was called the Anti-Comintern Treaty with Germany and Italy. It was allegedly designed to counter the communist influence, which was becoming stronger. This was the beginning of what the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini called the Axis, because the world would revolve around them, he said. And it was the Axis against which the Allies fought. Now, the treaty was mostly for show, but in actuality, in the minds of most people, divided the world into the good guys and the bad guys. The Soviet Comintern was the Communist International, an organization of Marxist parties preparing for the Red Crusade to spread world revolution. Now, this had caused a lot of nervousness in the 20s, but was not only something for the fascists to scream about. The communist threat wouldn't become a big issue again until the late 1940s. In any event, the Soviets formally dissolved the Comintern as a favor to their allies before World War II ended. Of course, hardly anybody noticed, being more concerned with other issues. In May of 1937, the War Policy Act was passed by the Congress, which modified the Neutrality Act of 1935, and it gave President Roosevelt some discretion in allowing loans and arms sales to foreigners. Many U.S. politicians saw America might not be able to stay out of any future world war, and War Policy Act was one of several efforts to deal with the problem by helping potential allies before the trouble got started. July 1937, Japan openly goes to war on China after several years of incursions and raids and skirmishes and battles. Japanese occupied much of the Chinese countryside in the late 30s and committed enough atrocities for American journalists to get a steady supply of gruesome stories. Well, with their troops penchant for conducting bayonet practice on Chinese prisoners and other similar events. Situation in China was always quite an issue in America. although less so in Europe, where they had Hitler and his Nazis to concern, keep their attention. March of 38, the Anschluss. Germany invades and annexes Austria. Added 6 million more German-speaking people to its population. And this is part of Hitler's policy of uniting all members of the German race into one nation, which was domestically quite popular in Germany. Unfortunately, most Europeans soon realized there was substantial German minorities in Czechoslovakia, Poland, the Soviet Union, and other nations. And while they didn't mind if Hitler went into Austria, they didn't want him coming to their neighborhood. July 38, fighting erupts between Japanese and Soviet troops on the Russian-Korean-Manchurian border. Now, all these issues, had anybody been watching, information readily available. Now, the Soviets won this little dust-up. Little was known about this in the West till after the war. But the reports of friction between Japanese and Soviet troops in Manchuria added to the general sense of unease in America. September 1938, after threats to march into western Czechoslovakia and seize the German-populated territories, Germany is approached by Great Britain and France with the offer of a compromise. At a conference in Munich, Hitler explained that this means giving him what he wants in return for a promise to behave in the future. So as a result of the Munich Pact, Germany annexed the western portions of Czechoslovakia with 3 million German-speaking Czechs without starting a general European war. Well, Czechoslovakia had treaties with France and several other countries, but these treaties were ignored as part of the Munich Pact. Nobody wanted a war, so they did anything they could to avoid it. October 1938, as part of the Munich Agreement, Polish troops occupy the Teschen area of Czechoslovakia, which they long claimed as Polish inhabited. Taking advantage of Czechoslovakian helplessness in the face of German aggression, while Hungary takes a slice of the southern part of the country as well. In January of 1939, President Roosevelt proposes a defense budget that, in effect, begins to rearm the U.S., Votes in Congress were very close, and it would take quite a traumatic event to push America into a major war. March of 1939, Germany annexes the Lithuanian port of Memel. More Germans reunited with Germany, this time via a vote of the largely German inhabitants. And ask about Germans living on its soil, Poland successfully resisted demands for more annexations of German-populated area. So at that point, Germany decided they were going to invade Poland. In March of 1939, German troops occupy what's left of Czechoslovakia and take pieces for themselves, directly violating the 1938 Munich Pact, I might add, while Hungary and Romania snip off little pieces for themselves, and Slovakia, which is eastern Czechoslovakia, proclaimed its independence. April of 1939, Hitler renounces Germany's 1935 naval agreement with Great Britain under the terms of which Germany voluntarily agreed to limit its fleet to about a third the size of Great Britain's. And this signaled to everybody Germany's intention to rebuild its fleet and challenge Great Britain for control of the oceans. Now, Germany had been rebuilding its fleet since 1935 and had been bending the terms of the treaty anyway by building ships larger than the official treaty limitations. April of 1939, Mussolini invaded Albania, which has for centuries frequently been ruled by Italian states, and that goes all the way back to the Roman Empire. El Duce, as he was called, this is yet another building block in his new Roman Empire. The rest of the world thought it was just basic naked aggression. Also in April of 1939, a German diplomatic note to Poland denounces the 10-year non-aggression treaty the two countries signed in 1934 and requests that the Poles agree to the annexation of the formerly German free city of Danzig to Hitler's Reich, as well as to Germany's control of the railway and highway connections between across Poland to East Prussia, which is separated from the rest of Germany by Polish territory. That was another result of World War I. July of 1939, 39, the U.S. gives notice of its intention to terminate its commercial treaty signed in 1911 with Japan that granted the latter the most favored nation status. This was intended to hurt the Japanese economically and force them to cease their attempts to conquer China. August 23, 1939, Germany signed the non-aggression treaty with the Soviet Union. And a secret clause in that treaty allowed both nations to partition Poland. Now, this treaty, even without their knowing of the secret clauses, came as a shock to everybody, especially the communists, as Germany had been rabidly anti-communist, and so it was, that meant it was anti-Soviet Union up to this point, while the Soviets had been enthusiastically anti-Nazi. It had been expected the heavily armed Soviet Union would keep Germany from being too aggressive. Now, Germans didn't have to worry about Russia, which had effectively become its ally under the terms of the treaty. August 24th, 1939, Great Britain and Poland signed a formal treaty of mutual assistance. This meant if Germany invaded Poland, Great Britain would declare war on Germany and a general war would begin. August of 1939, Japan had a rough month and denounced its anti-communist treaty with Germany because Germany and Soviet Union had just signed their non-aggression pact. Japan had also just been defeated in a major border battle with the Soviets in Mongolia. They were not happy campers by a long shot. September 1st, 1939, Germany invades Poland. Great Britain and France issue an ultimatum demanding Germany cease its aggression within 48 hours and dare declare war. Italy declares its neutrality and proposes a new conference similar to the Munich Conference. September 3rd, 1939, Germany, not having replied to their notice September 1st, Great Britain and France declared war. Now, all this byplay and interplay, the average individual in this country wasn't aware of. They're more concerned about could they put food on the table. September 17, 1939, the Soviet Union invaded Poland from the east under the terms of the Nazi-Soviet Pact. September 29, 1939, a new Soviet-German treaty is signed, resulting in the partitioning of Poland and various trade agreements. November 39, Soviet Union invaded Finland. The Finns fight back successfully by a combination of heroic resistance and Soviet ineptitude and obtain an end to the war on terms favorable to the Soviets, although less than what Stalin wanted in March of 1940. November 1939, the Congress allows arms sales to certain foreign nations, particularly Finland, Great Britain, and France. January of 40, American defense spending is increased to more than six times its 1939 levels. The Two Ocean Navy Bill increases shipbuilding so dramatically the United States will be the world's largest naval power by 1943. At the same time, there is still quite a strong isolationist sentiment in America. It's quite one thing to be prepared and another to get involved. April of 1940, Germany invaded Denmark and Norway. May 10, 1940, Germany invaded the Netherlands, Belgium, and France. And quickly demonstrating its military superiority, the German army defeats all its enemies and forces the British to retreat from the continent via the beaches near Dunkirk. Had the Germans not withheld their armor at Dunkirk, far less British soldiers would have been evacuated than actually were. At the last minute, the Germans withheld their armor and sent in just infantry. In June of 40, the Germans enter Paris. France surrenders. American military leaders and Americans in general are shocked at the speed at which Germany's defeated the British, French, and several smaller armies. Lurid and highly inaccurate newspaper accounts tell the Germans using 50-ton tanks with 90-millimeter guns. Now, the Germans had those by 1944, but not in 1940. And flamethrowers to cut through metal. Now, none of these things had appeared on the battlefield yet, but facts shouldn't get in the way of a good story as far as the press is concerned. Look at CNN. August of 1940, the Battle of Britain begins as German and British air forces struggle for air supremacy. That battle ended in September with a British victory. September 1940, Italy invades Egypt, which is occupied by British troops. September 1940, the Japanese begin the occupation of French Indochina. America protests and puts an embargo on shipments of scrap metal to Japan. See, America was a primary source of scrap metal for the Japanese, who were greatly dependent on this resource for their metal industries. I mean, think about it. Japan was an empire, but it was an island empire. And all the places they conquered were, in effect, at that time, third world countries. They were not major industrial countries. So they had to buy scrap metal where they could. September 1940, the German-Italian-Japanese 10-year military economic alliance treaty is signed. September 1940, the U.S. introduced the draft. October 1940, the Italians invade Greece and the Greeks successfully resist. December 1940, the British forces in Egypt chase the Italians back into Libya. Well, January 1941, the British launch another offensive against the Italians in North Africa while also invading Italian-held Ethiopia and Somalia. March of 41, the U.S. Congress introduced the Lend-Lease Act, which allows for the loan of massive amounts of weapons and equipment to nations fighting the Axis. Now, of course, we did all the lending, and very few people paid anything for it. The American taxpayer have always been sheeple. March of 1941, British troops land in Greece to assist in the defense of Greece against Italians and potential German intervention. March of 1941, German General Erwin Rommel and his Africa Corps come to the assistance of their Italian allies in North Africa. And with a surprise offensive, he puts the British on the defensive, forcing them back hundreds of miles. Well, April 1941, Germany invade Yugoslavia. A pro-Nazi government that had been ruling Yugoslavia had just been overthrown, and they also invaded Greece. By May of 41, both nations had surrendered. April of 1941, America takes control of Greenland from Nazi-occupied Denmark. May of 41, British forces driven out of Greece retreat to the island of Crete. Then the Germans launch an airborne assault on Crete and take the island away from the British. Also in May of 41, British naval forces chase the German battleship Bismarck across the North Atlantic and eventually sink it. The main Italian forces in Ethiopia and Somalia surrendered to the British. Also in May of 41, the U.S. merchant ship Robin Moore is sunk by a German U-boat in the Atlantic. America's getting nervous, but not nervous enough to make declaring war on Germany a popular issue. May of 41, a pro-Nazi uprising in Iraq is put down by British forces. June of 41, a British offensive in North Africa fails against the Africa Corps and its Italian allies. June of 41, German-French Vichyites, as they're called, and the Arab forces in Syria are defeated by British and Free French forces. June of 41, the Germans invade the Soviet Union, launching the largest military campaign in history. Now, this takes direct pressure off the Great Britain because Hitler can't invade Great Britain while fighting the Soviet Union. But there is fear if the Germans win and the Soviet Union, they'll possess the largest empire in modern times. Worldwide, communist parties and sympathizers who have argued the war is an imperialist one suddenly start screaming it's a democratic war, and the U.S. and everybody else had to get in to help democratic Soviet Union. I don't know where they found any democracy in the Soviet Union, but apparently they did. July 41, America freezes Japanese assets in the United States. Great Britain does the same thing. Japan is still trying to conquer China and has now occupied all of French Indochina. That was Vietnam and associated countries. All previous protests and sanctions haven't made any impression on the Japanese. The asset freeze, though, had the effect of prohibiting exports of British and American-controlled oil to Japan without government-issued permits. And as Japan was entirely dependent on these oil imports to keep its industry and military going, the embargo would eventually cripple Japan's war effort as well as its economy. Japanese had a choice between getting out of China and avoiding the bad effects of the embargo or going to war and hoping that would break the embargo. The rational approach would have been to give up China. But the powers that be that ran Japan at the time decided to go to war. July 41, America occupies Iceland, a Danish possession that had been occupied by British troops. Now, this was to assist the British by freeing the British garrison for other duties and put America forces one step closer to a war footing. August of 41, British and Soviet troops invaded Iran to overthrow a pro-Nazi government. The Iranians were seeking aid from the Germans, not so much because they were keen on Nazism, but because they wanted to get Great Britain out of the Persian Gulf. And the Persian Gulf was a key route for sending military and economic aid to the Soviet Union, as well as it was a major source of oil. September 41, American warships began protecting convoys going to Europe, escorting them halfway across the Atlantic. Now, German U-boats proceed to attack these escorts, sinking one and damaging another in October. U.S. Issues shoot-on-sight orders to the U.S. Navy, directed mainly against the U-boats. So, in effect, a state of war now exists between the U.S. and the German navies, even though the countries haven't declared war. November 41, a British offensive in North Africa has some success in driving the Axis forces back. November 41, renewal is made for 5 years of the Anti-Comintern Pact of November 25, 1936 in Berlin by Germany, Japan, Italy, Hungary, Spain, Manchukuo, which was a Japanese puppet state set up by the it was actually Mongolia. And the leader of it was the former emperor of China, who had been deposed by the Japanese. Bulgaria, Croatia, Denmark, Finland, Romania, Slovakia, and the nationalist government of China, which fought local communists throughout the 1930s. And many of these nations are talked into sending troops to fight the Russians. November to December 1941, the Soviet Union begins a counteroffensive against the Germans, pushing them back on all fronts, notably away from the suburbs of Moscow. Now, this was the third major defeat the Germans had in the war. The other two were the Battle of Britain and their reversals in North Africa. Up to that point, those were the only three defeats they had. Then in December 1941, things changed. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the Philippines, and other U.S. territories. British and Dutch possessions, colonies, so to speak, are also attacked. Well, that brought us into the war, to the relief of many Americans who feared the consequences of a complete Axis victory. Now, the unnerving series of events from the mid-30s to the eve of Pearl Harbor left few believing the U.S. wouldn't get involved in the war. And few believed that it was going to be easy. Now, every nation adopts a military policy suited to its priorities, traditions, strategies, and politics, given a particular international climate and limitations of its treasury. And for several centuries, this created a situation in Europe where most of the major nations were always on a war footing because, let's face it, in war is profit. Now, beginning in the 18th century, this defense spending continued into the 20th century. But by 1930, there existed what was perhaps the only generally peacetime military balance in European history. So there was a sense that permanent peace was more or less attainable. In any case, reasonable men could avoid war through negotiation. That's what Chamberlain, Prime Minister of Britain, kept trying to do. So military budgets were cut through the 1920s, and the onset of the Great Depression caused military establishments to be reduced even further. Then there were the Japanese aggressions in China, which were a year away. Stalin hadn't yet consolidated his power in the Soviet Union. Hitler was just another crackpot politician in Germany at the time, and Mussolini was still content to make the trains run on time. So it seemed to be a peaceful world, and the nations tailored their military establishment accordingly. Of course, they had no idea what was to come. You know, examining the character and quality of a nation's military establishment can't be wholly limited to bean counting, simply adding up the total forces and the resources. There are a number of other ways in which the military resources of different nations can be examined. An unusual one is to compare per capita military expenditure. That's the total amount expended on defense divided by the number of people in the country. Now, for example, Belgium spent what amounted to $13.50 per person. Military participation ratio, that's the number of civilians per person in uniform, was 277. And then you got the military budget divided by the number of men under arms. In Belgium, it was $3,751.50. Now, these were $1,930, dollars, of course. You know, the sad thing is, quietly, while everybody else was trying to feed their people, certain countries such as Germany were honing their military skills secretly. For example, the tank was born in the horrors of the First World War. 1914, the European powers marched off to war, expecting victory to be secured after a few months of intensive campaigning. Instead, the cumulative effects of the Industrial Revolution, mass armies, machine guns, quick-firing artillery, barbed wire, and the continuous production of supplies and munitions led to a protracted agony of trench warfare. And try as they might, the tactical commanders couldn't find a way to end the stalemate, which beginning toward the end of 1914 pretty much lasted until 1918. Repeated attempts to throw ever larger groups of men and material against relatively lightly held trench lines yielded little more than endless casualty lists. Although many of these generals may have deserved the collective nickname the Donkeys for the stubborn determination with which they kept trying more of the same in the face of ever-mounting casualties, not all were so thick-headed. A few soldiers and thinkers put their minds to trying to come up with a truly novel solution, most of which were impractical, like body armor for the troops, and or merely made matters worse, like poison gas, but there was one idea that actually worked. And that was the tank. Developed at the suggestion of Winston Churchill, who was first Lord of the Admiralty during the early part of the war, the tank was so obvious a solution to the problem that the Italians, the French, and the Russians were working along essentially the same lines. And in fact, a few years before, an Austrian officer, Günther Burstyn, contemplating the future of war, had proposed precisely the same vehicle. Now, the basic idea of the tank was pretty simple. You take a caterpillar track-laying vehicle, which were used in the agriculture time, equip it with armor and weapons, and that sucker could roll across the muddy, shell-packed, and trenched ground of no man's land, crushing obstacles like barbed wire. It could ignore enemy machine guns because of its armor, and with its own weapons, it could devastate enemy forces. The tank was a device that would enable the infantry to break loose from the stalemate of the trenches, and it worked. First serious test came in the Battle of Cambrai in 1917. Several hundred tanks and three British brigades attacked without preliminary artillery bombardment in support of six infantry divisions. And the results startled everybody. In less than 6 days, the Germans had been thrown back 4 miles. And that was the most significant advance on the Western Front since early in 1915. Unfortunately, the mechanical unreliability of the tanks, coupled with a shortage of infantry replacements and a series of skillful German counterattacks, forced the British back over the next few weeks. But even the most dull-witted generals were impressed at what the tanks could actually do. And it was Germany that made the most use of the tank. I mean, the Blitzkrieg was basically a German idea. Well, now the only American ever granted the title Master of the Sword by the French Army Cavalry School at Saumur was George Patton. He was an expert swordsman, and so expert was he that as a junior officer he had represented the U.S. in the 1912 Olympics, finishing fifth in the decathlon. He even designed the last saber ever issued to U.S. Cavalry, which is still used today for ceremonial purposes. The first British infantry battalion to report not a single illiterate man in its ranks was the 1st Gordon Highlanders in 1933. Now, this may not seem like a major achievement, but in fact, it was overwhelmingly so. Long experience has demonstrated the better educated a man is, the better a soldier he's going to make. One reason for the superior performance of some armies in World War II, the Germans, the Americans, the British, was the high proportion of literate men in the ranks, in contrast to most of the less successful armies, the Italian, the Chinese, and even the Soviets, who had a significant number of illiterate fighters. And the smarter the soldiers, the quicker battles are brought to an end. You know, in peacetime, armies and navies are supposed to consider possible threats and make plans accordingly. Of course, such matters have to be kept secret. A journalistic leak would lead to an embarrassment, even an international incident. As a result, from quite early in the 20th century, the U.S. Army began referring to potential opponents, allies, locations, and objectives by various colors. So while discussing a hypothetical operation, the powers that be could refer to War Plan Indigo or Plan Red, knowing that it was the plan for the occupation of Iceland in the event of Denmark fell under the control of an unfriendly power. And they would also discuss our options if we had to assist Lemon in the event it was attacked by Olive or was allied with Red against Black. See, the problem is, journalists are only concerned about themselves and the story, not the bigger picture. 1937, the British Army Riding School at Weedon had a budget of £20,000. That's about $1 million in 1994 dollars. For 38 students, that's over £526 or $26,000 per pupil, while the Tank Corps School with 500 students had to make do with £46,000, or about £83 per pupil. So this demonstrated the priorities of the senior leadership of the British Army in maintaining tradition rather than preparing for war. Keep in mind, and I heard it when I was on active duty, generals, a few of the generals, looked at things in terms of what they experienced as second lieutenants some 30 years ago. And if they didn't watch it, they'd get folks hurt and killed. Now, the United States enacted the first peacetime military draft in its history, September 16, 1940. The intent was to train a sizable body of men as the deterrent against any attack. Under terms of the Selective Service Act, The president was authorized to draft up to 900,000 men between the ages of 20 and 36 for service not to exceed 1 year, with a provision for an extension to 18 months in national emergencies. And everybody began to register October 16th, 1940. Names were first drawn October 29th. And as the first batch of selectees was inducted November 25th, men sometimes referred to their service as being on the Ohio plan or over the hill in October. In the summer of 41, it was proposed to amend the bill to extend the term of service to as long as 30 months. Now, both right-wing and left-wing elements contested this bitterly. Nevertheless, on August 18, 1941, that amendment was passed. The House of Representatives passed it by one vote, and that helped convince the Japanese military leaders the United States lacked the will for war. If they just held out, we'd eventually give up. Now, without the Selective Service Program, the U.S. would have been even less prepared for war than it actually was. Of course, didn't help the folks called up in 1940. Because after Pearl Harbor, everybody was in for the duration. Most not getting out until mid-45, and a few not even until early in 1946. Well, in 1939, a newspaper subjected the speech patterns of the principal world leaders at the time to analysis regarding the use of the first person singular. And the results weren't surprising. Adolf Hitler was prone to use I or the equivalent about once every 53 words, and Benito Mussolini used it about every 83 words. Franklin Roosevelt said I about once every 100 words. French Premier Edouard Daladier referred to himself in his fashion only once every 234 words. Well, since that time, the analysis was made. Winston Churchill was an unemployed politician. He was omitted from the survey. However, in his blood, toil, tears, and sweat address to the House of Commons on May 13, 1940, he used I once every 35 words, which gives you a little bit of insight into their personalities. Whereas most of the senior officers and virtually all the political leaders in World War I had seen little or no serious military service prior to 1914, all the senior officers in World War II and many of the political leaders had actually served in World War I. And their experiences are generally regarded as having greatly influenced the character of the war, because they were determined not to repeat the senseless slaughter they had witnessed. Harold Alexander, who commanded the Allied 15th Army Group in Italy, had been an officer in the Royal Guards. Terry De La Mesa Allen, among the most famous U.S. infantry division commanders in World War II, was a cavalry officer who served with distinction in the infantry in France. Ladislaw Anders, who commanded the Polish Army Corps in Italy, enlisted in the Russian cavalry in 1914, joined the Polish Army after the Russian Revolution, and later served as a senior staff officer in the Russia-Polish War of 1919 through 1921. Claude Auchinleck, who had a tough time at Rommel's hands in North Africa, had been an Indian Army infantry officer. Pietro Badoglio, who became the Prime Minister of Italy after the fall of Mussolini, had been an infantry officer, rose to command a corps before ending the war as Deputy Chief of the General Staff. Theodor von Bock, who commanded various army groups early in the war, had been a Guards officer, winning the Pour le Mérite, the highest decoration in the Imperial Germany, which is the equivalent of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Martin Bormann, Hitler's principal aide in 44 and 45, was an 18-year-old conscript in the artillery very late in the war, but never saw any active service. Omar Bradley, the principal American ground commander in Northwest Europe from D-Day to the end of the war, spent the early war just as did his World War II boss Eisenhower, training troops and trying to get overseas. At one point, he was a subordinate of Patton, and before things were done, he was Patton's superior. Alan Brooke, chief of the British Imperial Staff for most of the war, had been an artillery officer. Simon Bolivar Buckner, killed in action, commanding the U.S. 10th Army in Okinawa, was an aviation instructor. Wilhelm Canaris, who headed Hitler's intelligence service while plotting against him, began the war as an officer in the Graf Spree's unfortunate squadron. Being on the only ship to escape the German disaster in the Falklands in 1915, went back to Germany where he transferred to the intelligence service, working mostly in Spain, where he made many contacts and would eventually prove useful. Claire Chennault, commander of the Flying Tigers in the 14th Air Force, was a schoolteacher in 1917. Becoming a pilot after attending officer candidate school, but saw no overseas service. Winston Churchill, beginning the war as First Lord of the Admiralty, spent some time commanding an infantry battalion on the Western Front after the disastrous Gallipoli campaign and later became Secretary at War. Mark Clark, commander of the 5th Army in Italy, served as an infantry officer in the American Expeditionary Force, being wounded as a battalion commander. Andrew Cunningham, the most distinguished British sea dog since Nelson, served in destroyers, rose to command the HMS Scorpion. William Wild Bill Donovan, who headed the OSS, was commander of the New York's old Fighting 69th during World War I, wounded three times and got a Medal of Honor in the process. James Doolittle, who led the Tokyo Raid in 42 and commanded the 8th Air Force, had been an enlisted flying instructor in the U.S. Hugh Dowding, who led fighter command during the Battle of Britain, was an artilleryman in 1914, transferred to the Royal Flying Corps. Dwight Eisenhower, the Supreme Commander, European theater, was a 1915 graduate of West Point. A temporary infantry major by the end of the war, he was unable to get overseas. James Forrestal, undersecretary and later Secretary of the Navy, who died mysteriously, left a lucrative Wall Street law firm to serve as a naval aviator in World War I, won the Navy Cross. Francisco Franco, the Caudillo of Spain, was a very young, very brave infantry officer in Morocco. Bernard Freyberg, who commanded the New Zealand Division in North Africa and Italy, was a volunteer with Pancho Villa in Mexico when the war began. Enlisted in the British Army and accumulated quite a heroic record, ending the war as a 28-year-old battalion, 28-year-old division commander with a Victoria Cross. Maurice Gamelin, who bungled the defense of France in 1940, served as a staff officer throughout the war. Charles de Gaulle, leader of the Free French, began the war as a lieutenant in Henri Pétain's 33rd Infantry Regiment. At Verdun, he became a prisoner of war in 1916. Roy Gegler, who's one of the most distinguished U.S. Marine Corps commanders in the war and the only Marine ever to command a field army, was a Marine aviator and won the Navy Cross. George VI, who proved an excellent king, had served as a junior officer in the Royal Navy during the earlier war and was under fire at the Battle of Jutland. Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propagandist, was physically unfit for military service because of a club foot and spent the war as a student. After World War I, he would attribute his limp to a war wound. Hermann Göring, head of the Luftwaffe, long Hitler's right-hand man, was a fighter ace with the famed Flying Circus, which he commanded for a time, earning Imperial Germany's highest decoration. Lord Gort, who commanded the Doon British Expeditionary Force of 1939-1940, was an infantry officer and won a Victoria Cross. Heinz Guderian, founder of Germany's Panzer Arm and for a time chief of the General Staff, began the war as a cavalry officer, who later moved over to the staff. William Halsey, commander of the 3rd Fleet in the Pacific, skippered various destroyers in Europe during 1917 and 1918, got a Navy Cross in the process. Thomas Hart, who commanded the Atlantic Fleet in the days of 1941-42 and went on to the Senate, enlisted during the Spanish-American War and commanded a submarine squadron operating out of Ireland during World War I. Louis Hershey, head of the Selective Service System, was a National Guard officer called to active duty in France in 1918. Rudolf Hess, one of Hitler's closest confidants early in the war, enlisted as a volunteer in 1914, rose to lieutenant in the Stormtroopers, ended the war as a pilot, actually ended the war in prison, Spandau. Heinrich Himmler, head of the SS and Gestapo, was a young officer cadet in 1918, never saw any military combat service. Adolf Hitler had been an infantry runner, a messenger, winning an Iron Cross, First Class, and Second Class, plus several other decorations. Wounded twice and once gassed, for a time he served in trenches directly opposite those held by the battalion commanded by Winston Churchill. Albert Kesselring, Luftwaffe Marshal, one of the most tenacious defensive fighters in the war, was an artilleryman in 1914. Ernest King, Chief of Naval Operations for most of the war, was Chief of Staff to the Commander of the Atlantic Fleet throughout the war, got a Navy Cross. Ivan Stefanovich Konev, Soviet Marshal and Front Commander, began World War I as a private in the Tsar's Army. Jean-Marie de Letter de Tassigny, who commanded the French 1st Army in 44 and 45, served as a cavalry officer and was severely wounded by a saber during a mounted skirmish in 1914. Probably the last notable soldier to have had such an experience. Rita von Lieb, who commanded various German army groups early in the war, was an artillery officer during 1914 to 1918. Douglas MacArthur, who commanded the Philippines and Southwest Pacific, was an infantry officer and in the war as a brigadier general. Carl Gustav Emil von Mannerheim, the Finnish chief of staff, was a Russian infantry officer in 1914. Ended the war as a brigadier general in U.S. terms. So it goes on and on and on. A lot of the people who had no trouble sending people to die, many of them had had their own military experiences. Some did not. 61 of the 164 men in West Point's class of 1915 attained the rank of general. Two were generals of the Army. That's 5-star. Two generals held 4-stars. 7 lieutenant generals, 3-stars. 50 major generals, 2-stars. And brigadier generals had 1-star. This earned them the collective nickname, the class the Stars Fell On. Interestingly enough, the first man in the class to become a general was Luis Raul Estevez, who was promoted to brigadier general in the Puerto Rican National Guard in 1939, some time before his subsequently more famous classmates, Eisenhower and Bradley. You know, the homicide rate in pre-war Nazi Germany was only 12.8% of that of the U.S., an annual rate of 0.75 murders per 100,000 people against 5.84 figures that, of course, exclude officially sanctioned killings. Herbert Hoover's presidency has the distinction of being the only one in American history during which not a single major combat ship was added to the Navy. Now, this is sometimes attributed to the fact the president was a Quaker, but more accurately, the result of a profound belief that perpetual peace had been attained in the 20s as a result of all the disarmament agreements and things like the Kellogg-Briand Pact, in which all the powers agreed to make nice and not make war no more. And then in Munich, on September 29, 1939, British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain, French Premier Edouard Daladier and Italian Duce Benito Mussolini concocted a deal with German Fuhrer Adolf Hitler that gave the German-inhabited Sudetenland to Czechoslovakia to Germany. Statement from Chamberlain about that pact, which he made back at home after the conference: "I believe it is peace for our time. It's the ultimate definition of appeasement in the face of aggression. It's a peace at any price delusion," as many of his detractors said. And they turned out to be correct. Well, tomorrow night, we're going to talk about some things about the world at war that we were never told in school. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.